Thank you for joining us for the Dev Team. We're your hosts, Mark Onsman,
Jake Overall,
and Ryan Coates.
We're a group of developers and instructors here to discuss the world of software development. So whether you're brand new or an experienced developer, we're here to chat on topics that affect our lives each and every day. This week on the Dev Team, Jake starts us off with static code analysis as the word of the day. Ryan brings us the latest news with the framework laptop. And finally, I want to know when it's time to quit my job. All right, a little bit of a cheeky intro there, Jake. Sorry for that. We'll get to that more when we actually get to the deep dive.
Yeah, it's all good. You know, I'm going to start us off by talking about static code analysis, or essentially how the computer is already better at your job than you are anyways. So,
wow.
Okay. I'm going to start making some extra show notes here.
playing right off of last week's episode, actually, with like Copilot. We've talked about testing this season. We've talked about, the tools that analyze the code that we write in order to build more tools. Right. And so static code analysis is one of those things, right? And static code analysis is all about, am I writing the language in accordance to the way that everyone else in the industry would expect the language to be written? And this comes into things naming conventions. Are you using the right Pascal casing? Are you using camel casing? Are you using snake case, kebab casing? And if you don't know what any of those types of casings are, well, then maybe you're not ready to actually listen to the rest of this episode. But it's definitely one of those things where, if I'm writing something in Python, I should be adhering to kind of the Python standards for writing that language, right? And there's tools out there that will specifically evaluate your code and say, are you adhering to all of these different things, right? And we've talked about different metrics. We've talked about code coverage. We talked about some of those other things exist. So with static code analysis, how is it different, right? And I think that's one of the questions to specifically answer. And really, it comes down to being able to kind of customize and flavor what you specifically want as a company, right? And so that's where we could potentially say, okay, traditionally speaking, we want to use an underscore to denote that we have a private variable. Do we want that to actually be a standard within our company, or do we not want that? You know, when it comes to the language itself, the language doesn't care. So how do we say, let's enforce those rules across an entire code base or across many different code bases, right? And so that's where tools like static code analysis really come into play. But Ryan, I think you actually do quite a bit with static code analysis and, trying to make teams adhere to standards. Is that right?
Yeah, no, definitely. A couple of the tools that we work on in my part of the org are around kind of security testing and things like that. You know, I treat static, acronyms mean different things to different people. You know, we've talked about things like cloud and how generic the term is. So to me, SCA is kind of, it's kind of a superset and encompasses a lot of different types of scan and checks that apply to the static code base. So when we talk about static code analysis, we're talking about things I do to the source code, not the built artifact, not the running process, but just source code, right? So that could be, just things like you're talking about, like style and quality guidelines. If you're writing Python, are you meeting PEP 8, right? If you're doing .NET, are you using the right casings and stylings? And again, if you've got a corporate style guide, absolutely, that plays into that as well. But you also have things like, static application security testing, or SAST. And that's kind of like actually looking, okay, do you have vulnerabilities? Are you writing your methods poorly? Or do you have a bunch of public things that shouldn't be defined as public, right? You've got things like software composition analysis, which is, okay, let's look at all the libraries you're using. Probably super important to you JavaScript developers, right? And also, what is their license, right? It's like, that's one thing a lot of people forget when they go into the private sector and they're writing for another company, not themselves. If I use a piece of code that the license is ambiguous or specific in that, like GPL or something, it's like, can now commercially use this without also keeping all of my source code open, or, what have I done? And so, a lot of firms will have rules about that, and that you need to, how do you know? You go React new app and you've already got 100,000 dependencies, right?
So I think you see this a lot in, in talking about security and external libraries and open source. You see this a lot in government entities, especially ones that do have those privacies, where it's like, hey, I cannot bring in any open source code because goodness knows what kind of dependencies or vulnerabilities specifically you're going to be bringing in. And I think that's super important that even people are aware of, right? As you said, when we're building for ourselves, just grab whatever library and bring it in. And, Jake and I are proponents of don't grab a library if it brings in like one method, just learn to write that one method. Because especially in those situations, like it's important that you're not just throwing code at the wall.
So you don't want a repeat of the left pad incident?
Yeah, left pad, right? Completely break the entire JavaScript ecosystem. And talking specifically on these terms, right? Like we talk about vulnerabilities and threat analysis and whatnot. There was just a NPM package over the weekend that was identified to specifically steal Chrome passwords while it was running, right? There's a file named like a.exe. I can't remember the name of the package. It's been pulled down since the weekend, but yeah, it was a developer. He used 12 different release cycles to slowly integrate essentially a vulnerability that was specifically designed to steal passwords. And it was a HTTP server, and that's specifically what it was designed for. And so things like that absolutely get into play. And, you know, if you don't have some sort of analysis that's going on with, you know, what dependencies are we pulling in? If we are pulling in, you know, a giant library, take something like Express. Do you really need the entire Express library, or do you only need like four or five things from it, right? Let's talk about named imports as opposed to like default imports, you know, and a lot of that comes into play. And, you know, when in the world of delivering things across the web, you know, we're trying to get the delivery of the package down as small as possible, yet we're still importing entire libraries. And, you know, what's to what end, right?
I think to bring it back a little bit to static code analysis, the other thing talking about other libraries that I've found that's important and good is we've talked about before on this podcast being a code ninja, right? Being able to integrate your code without significant differences between, you know, choices in how you write functions or how you write naming conventions and things like that. The other one that we use a lot that I think initially developers and maybe through the lens specifically of our students really hate at first, but then go to love is things like ESLint. You have that actively linting file that says, hey, you are not adhering to these rules we've specifically identified. And then just tying that directly into your formatter, because it shouldn't be like this overwhelming burden to go through and clean up all your code. There is ways to just say, here's the rules, and just automatically format my code to adhere to them.
It is interesting you mentioned how at the beginning they don't like it and then they come to love it. But we use some tools for API spec linting, and some of the default rule sets that, you know, that come with it, you know, the way it implements it in things like VS Code, basically everything has a squiggly line under it, the whole document, until you start cleaning up bits of it. And so people look at that and they're like, yeah, no, right? It's like, that's a lot of wrong. I don't really know where to start. And you know, for the most part, linters are then good about, okay, you've got squigglies, but we'll also tell you what rules you're violating and what line that they're being violated on and stuff like that. Obviously, when we talk about API specs, talking about YAML for the most part. So being able to identify things, you know, like you would in normal source code seems to be a little more challenging for some of the linters, at least in VS Code's integration perspective. But no, I think all of this kind of methodology kind of plays into this kind of DevOps concept that we talk about called shifting left, right? And it's about moving more and more to earlier on in the process, right? It's not something you do right at the end. Oh, I've written a 4,000 line application, and now I'm going to go and look at whether or not it's testable. Now I'm going to go look at if the licenses for the 400,000 dependencies are okay to use, right? When you start building these into your pipelines, you start doing them on day one. I've written three lines. It's a single function. It's an agile, you know, we talked about agile the other week, right? I've started, is everything up to par? I've got 10 dependencies right now. Are they all kosher? Oh, they are? Cool. Do I have any massive vulnerabilities? No? Okay, cool. And you're not testing everything here. You know, anytime you're talking about automated tests and stuff, they have value in context, right? You're never going to replace a real human. Well, GitHub might try. You're never going to replace a real human actually looking at source code and looking at running applications. And humans are very clever at trying things outside the box and, you know, trying to get things to break the way. And that's why we have human testers, right? That's why we have a testing role, testing tasks, because your automated tool is going to do one thing. It's going to do it very well. And it's going to take a lot of your plate and maybe kind of surface code smells or, you know, big easy ticket items, but it's not. And, you know, you're also potentially going to get false positives too when you're using tools and you're depending on them too much. So, but once you've kind of got it down and that's happening from the start of your process, this is happening every time you do a commit, right? Every time you do a commit, this process is happening. So you might've only committed four more lines and you're getting a tick in the box or a, whoa, what did you just put there? Right. So I think that shifting left mentality is really important to get that feedback in real time and shorten that feedback loop for people.
I would say, you know, it is difficult to get started though, right? And I think that's one of the biggest reasons why people sometimes don't do this is because there's a lot of configuration up front, right? There's a lot of, well, I need to get my templating. I need to get all of this taken care of. So as I pull these in, is my entire IDE environment set up to accommodate those things, right? And it, that's not an easy task, and that's not one that I would, you know, stick juniors on to begin with anyways, right? But I would say is probably people's biggest roadblocks in being able to even just get started with those types of tools. And, you know, it's small things at a time. Start with the linter, you know, and then graduate from there. There's third-party services. Code Climate is one I think I've plugged before. I absolutely love that service. Does an excellent job of static code analysis and giving you kind of grades and, you know, tips and tricks on code cleanup. So just a couple different ideas out there for those interested in maybe dabbing a foot into that.
Yeah, kind of my closing thought on that is essentially that, you know, you got to tackle that technical debt early before it builds up, right? Just like Ryan was saying, you're doing little things at a time. It's kind of that whole idea behind test-driven development. I write the test before the code, so it's already handled. I've already got the testing there, but there can be a lot of architecture and setup to even get that working as well to say, hey, I need these test suite built, put in, running. And there's tools to help with that setup and things like that. And ultimately, it's just a matter of time. You just got to do it a couple times and then you'll be comfortable with it. But if you don't allow that technical debt to become overwhelming, if you make those decisions early on for your linter and get it installed and configured and you write those tests early on, later on, it's not a big of a deal because, yeah, I'm adding four lines. So here's a quick test. Here's the four lines, done. And I'm not worrying about, hey, here's, you know, 1,000, 200,000, whatever lines of legacy code that now I need to cover.
Well, and that's one of the things also when I give my talk on automation and DevOps to students when they graduate, you know, one of the things we talk about is as a dev, you know, where we, you know, our goal is to be as lazy as possible, right? We should be, you talk about, you know, how it's hard to get started, but building automation around that, you look at when you scaffold out a project with like, you know, React New or Vue New, whatever the equivalent is, right? It goes and does a lot of Vue specific things for you, puts files in the right place, creates folder structures. But what's to stop you having, you know, Mark New App, right? And Mark's New App runs the Vue command, also scaffolds out an empty pipeline file, also calls the, what was that program code?
The Code Climate.
Yeah, calls Code Climate, registers a new app and injects that into the, you know, into the pipeline. You as a developer, you have at your fingertips languages. You can do all these kind of things for yourself. And now when you go and start a new project, even if it's a little Sunday night kind of thing, you now have all this taken care of. And outside of keeping that up to date over time, which, you know, especially when you're depending on external APIs, breaking changes happen. But outside of keeping that kind of maintained a little bit, that automation is going to serve you well wherever you go, whatever you do. And you may tweak it for various employers who have specific kind of needs and things, but you as a developer can start your way of working quickly and easily. So.
Yeah, that is definitely something that we do with our students. You know, we have our BCW Create, right? It's a little command line tool that we've set up. And, you know, it's one of those things when you very first get started into programming, I'm talking, you know, how students come to us. It's, you know, they've never been a developer before. They've never had any of this before. Every new file is scary. Every new file in a project can be intimidating. And really it's small pieces at a time that it takes to consume that. But absolutely, you know, having those different templates in place, I think is a must.
All right. Well, thanks, Jake. So don't have too much news today. I do want to talk about one little interesting thing. Basically the pre-orders of what was called the Framework Laptop have started going out to people. And I don't have mine yet, but I'm, you know, eagerly keeping an eye on the shipping emails. So the Framework Laptop is this interesting concept that people have tried before. People have talked about for a long time. And, you know, you've heard recently in the news, the whole right to repair kind of conversation, things like that. So the Framework Laptop is, it's a laptop that's been designed from the ground up to be user serviceable, replacement parts. At the same time, not ugly. I think that's one of the arguments around modern laptops and unibodies and soldered on parts and stuff is, oh, well, we can't make a laptop this robust and this, you know, this well-built and this, you know, thin if we don't do all these things. And I think what Framework have done is shown that that's not actually entirely true. I mean, this thing's no thicker than a Surface laptop or a, you know, maybe an older MacBook Pro. You know, when it arrives, you can pick the keyboard in it. You pick the storage, you pick the memory. There's a couple of CPU options. Obviously, the way mobile CPUs work today, they are soldered. They're not pin boards or anything like that. So that part is one part. But even that, they've designed to be replaceable. Now, again, obviously, what the future holds, nobody knows. But the idea is each one of these components you can pick yourself or you can buy with them. It literally comes with a screwdriver with the box. And all the screws have the exact same bit size. right? Even though some of the screws are different, they're all color coded. So if you've got different thread requirements stuff, I think iFixit just gave it a repairability score of 10, which
insane.
Yeah, they were very excited about it. They're like, whoa. So it's five screws on the bottom and they're captive screws. You take them off and you get access under the keyboard. And like memory goes in here, storage goes in here. The battery's replaceable. Everything's labeled. And I think this is one of the things that made me think about this from a developer perspective. Firstly, as a developer, having a laptop that you can do all these things with is nice. But you know, there's a certain user experience. You open it up and every piece of component has like a QR code on it. And so if I'm not maybe super comfortable building a computer, but you know, I can plug in Lego, you know, I can point my phone at it. Come, hey, okay, this is the memory. You put it in this way. It just slides in, you know, that kind of thing. And you get kind of information on what's the support matrix, what type of memory you should have. And you know, same with the battery. Oh, okay. If you're going to replace the battery, make sure you take this cable out first. That's the only thing you got to do. Then take out the three screws. Battery gets replaced. I mean, it's a very compelling piece of kit. Now, obviously, there's some limitations at the moment. I think they're going through certification for Thunderbolt. So there's no Thunderbolt support right now. But the way they expose the I/O ports, there basically is four USB-C 3.2 ports, I think, on the side. And then these modules plug into them. So let's say I'm going on a work trip and I've got to present. I'm going to pull out some of those ports, make sure I've got my HDMI and my display port, because you never know what you're going to get in a conference room. But maybe when I'm coming to, you know, a friend's house to play some games, maybe I'm pulling out one of those and plugging in the 1 terabyte storage expansion, right? Or, you know, a couple USB-A ports for my, you know, gaming mouse and keyboard, because no wireless there, you know what I mean? And you can just swap these out on the fly. Then you could carry around 10 of them. It would probably take up less room than all the dongles that I have for my MacBook Pro. I'm excited to see where it goes. I think it's a very compelling piece of gear, and the design approach and mentality around it, I think is something that I think a lot of developers and IT professionals in general like miss. Like we all grew up hacking away on computers, and well, not all of us, but you know, I mean, this is how a lot of us got into the industry. We were keen, we were hardware keen, we were software keen, and we had access to equipment like that back in the day, whether it was a little computer at school that you could just write code on in BASIC, or, you know, these days open up a browser and start coding in JavaScript. I mean, this is how a lot of people start their journey. Yeah. And being able to do that from a hardware perspective as well, and not have to pay the vendor, we'll call it the vendor tax, every 2 years because you need a new one because you scratched the paint on that one and there's no fix for it.
Right? Yeah, I find that absolutely fascinating, right? It's like everything old is new again, right? Let's bring back the good old days of the desktop, right? And you know, I remember the days when
desktop being a good old day of the desktop.
Well, I mean, and just talking about that composability, right? Like I remember that same thing. I used to be, you know, go down to CompUSA, right? And pick up my new RAM, or I'd pick up a new, I know, right? I really am, you know, but it would be, hey, walk into CompUSA, let's buy a new hard drive today, right? Let's buy some more RAM. You know, let's switch out the video card, right? I would save up and buy a new video card, not a whole new computer, right? And the fact that that composability is coming into a laptop, that's something we really haven't seen before. For the longest time, laptops are, you know, you use it for 2 years. And like you said, you basically throw it away at the end of the 2 years. And, you know, and there's, you know, been some introduction with SSD hard drives where it's like, hey, if you want to upgrade the hard drive, okay, well, that's pretty easy to swap in and out, but you know, true composability, that sounds very powerful.
Yeah. And I think, you know, obviously if you look at some of the big, gaming and kind of, you know, workstation class laptops, I don't think they've completely taken away that ability, right? I think a lot of those you can still probably buy an HP EliteBook the way you can swap the hard drive out, and you know, or the NVMe, or add more memory. I think it's one of those excuses people have made for the Ultrabook class. It's like, oh, to get this light and thin, you can't have these things. Ha ha ha. And what framework have done is said, well, actually, that's not true. This laptop's like, you know, 2 pounds or whatever, and, you know, tiny, you know, doesn't have all the options they want right now. You know, they obviously went through it. I think they started designing this a year and a half ago. That was the, you know, and they managed to pull this all together during the, you know, the struggles last year with supply chain and stuff like that. I'm excited to see where it goes. Like I said, I know they're going through Thunderbolt certification, trying to get that. I know there's talk of what expansion cards do people want. You know, a lot of people are asking for discrete graphics as an option. How do we get that to plug in? And who knows what that'll be? Because I think mobile graphics is also usually a soldered option, right? So what does it look like? I'm just excited to see where it goes. And like I said, I got my pre-order coming, and I mean,
so what's introductory prices for getting into it?
I think the, you know, and I'll be honest, the configurator was down today, I think, cause everybody started announcing they're getting their pre-orders. So there was a bunch of YouTube videos today about it. So I think, so the configurator was hanging up on me. I know the DIY edition starts at $749. And I think that includes the CPU. I think that's probably assuming no memory or storage, like bring your own completely. You can obviously add those from them. You also have a non-DIY edition where if you don't want to put things together yourself, you can order it and then still have the ability to replace it later if you're not super computer savvy, right? But no, $749, and I think that's a 11th gen Core I something. I'm not sure which one. No,
that's really not that entry.
And then obviously I think the board supports up to 64 gigs of RAM. So that's nice and an option. And I think, you know, it's got an M2 slot. I think it's NVMe 4. So that's like, you put a 2 terabyte, you know.
Does it have the new TPM chip?
That's a great question.
I mean, that's going to be very relevant, right? Especially come October. So
that is a great question. And I have failed to check that.
Might be something to look into.
Should
for
know
sure.
better considering I've already got Windows 11 running at home somewhere.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest thing is, you know, there's people who want what they want, right? That I specifically, and, you know, I'm not particular, but I know people are, right? Oh, I want this specific, you know, graphics card or this specific memory chipset or, you know, whatever. So is it pretty, like, you don't have to get just their brand of stuff to fit it in, or how does that work?
No, think about like a normal x86 computer, right? So obviously the chip options are limited because they're soldered on, and they'll have support requirements based on that chip and chipset as to what speed memory you can use, what size, what speed NVMe you should be using. But even if it was only an NVMe PCIe 3 slot, you can still stick a 4-1 in there. It just won't work as fast, right? It still works. Same with memory. You put faster memory in, it'll just downclock it usually, unless it's particularly power hungry. You know, usually the chipsets limit things like maximum capacity from an addressing standpoint, things like that, which is why 64 gigs is a limit. That's probably a chipset limit. So no, if you want to go get Crucial memory, you could. If you want to go get Corsair memory, you could. If you wanted slightly faster memory than the cheap stuff you bought last year, as long as the board supports the faster memory, you could go do that. It also allows you to make compromises up front and say, well, I don't necessarily need to spend this much on day one. 8 gigs of RAM's fine. I'll use it as a webmail device for the first 6 months. Then I can put 64 in later. Yay. Okay, now I can use it to do some development work on or some VMs, whatever. I think you're right. I mean, that's, and one of the things people talk about, you know, with right to repair, a lot of people think that means that we all got to go back to boxy computers and phones. It's like, I have no problem. I'll keep buying my iPhone. You know, for something that small, I'm totally okay with somebody building it and doing all the gluing and, you know, splicing to make it all work in that tiny package. But there's very little excuse for why that should be the case on a laptop that's, you know, 14 inches wide or something. There's plenty of room in there given modern technology. One of the good things I did like that I heard from the framework team was they're putting out CAD designs for, so the motherboard obviously is removable with the CPU on it. I heard they're putting out CAD designs to build a chassis for it. So if you do upgrade the laptop motherboard, you can then, you know, reuse that motherboard in some other kind of system around the house.
Yeah, perfect.
Right.
And so, I mean, with talking about right to repair, like generally speaking, you open up a laptop, you void your warranty, all that other stuff, right? So how do the warranties set out with the framework laptop?
Oh, no, that's absolutely part. Like I said, from the ground up, this has been one of the big design decisions for them. It is supposed to be user upgradable. It's supposed to be something that you could do. Now, that said, if you start poking the screwdriver in, you know, places you shouldn't, I'm assuming they've got ways to tell. But, you know, you're not voiding your warranty for opening it up. That's part of you. If you get the DIY one, you can't actually use it until you open it up.
Perfect.
But yeah, you go and do something silly with it. And I'm sure they've got other, you know, kind of like how you get the water stickers on things. Yes, you did get this wet because the sticker's blue, right? So they've probably got things like that in there. You know, again, I haven't read too much detail into it. I was just super excited that they've started to come out, and I'm going to be sitting around my mailbox.
Throw money at it first and then figure it out later.
Usually how it works.
All right. Well, I'm going to kind of go ahead and close us off with a topic that maybe makes Jake a little nervous. How do you know when it's time to leave your job? To clarify, I'm not currently looking.
It depends on your boss, doesn't it?
Not currently looking. I would almost say like you should constantly be looking.
But
right?
let's circle up on that and specifically kind of frame this into a couple of questions here, because we do get juniors ask us that question from time to time. You know, hey, they take their first job, and a lot of times as a developer, right, like your first job is not that glamour job. You're not working for that perfect company, or maybe it's, you know, the product you're building is maybe not something you're super passionate about, but you're getting your feet wet. And how do you know when it's time to say, all right, I've learned what I can here, or, you know, is it a pay thing? And I think this is going to be a little bit different for everybody, so I'm not asking for an answer here. Just kind of what your opinions are when you've left jobs in the past, or you've identified certain things to you. What are some of the top couple of things that you identify in a job that says, you know, I think it's time for me to start moving on?
So it's definitely, it's one of those questions where, like you said, there's not necessarily a right answer. And a lot of it is situational. Depends on the time, right? Like, I may be working for a company that I absolutely love what I'm doing. And I love all the people I'm working with, but I'm in a financial position where, quite frankly, I just need more money. And so I may chase money, right? And so I may leave a job specifically because someone else is going to give me a $20,000 pay bump. Totally reasonable reason to leave a company. At another point in time, we could potentially say, well, you know, I love the people I'm working with, and I like what I'm doing. I'm not making as much as I wish I was, but I'm still going to stay here, right? And it's not necessarily a money issue, right? It's more of, do I find fulfillment and joy in what I'm doing on a daily basis, right? And so I think there's never an easy answer to this question. It's always situational. It always kind of depends on, you know, are you fulfilled, right? And I think, at least for me specifically, I want to do what I want to do that makes me happy, right? I talk to our students about this all the time, and I talk about having the Sunday blues, right? If you got the Sunday blues because you know you got to get up, go to work the next day, and you're just dreading that concept, then I think it's time to find a new job, right? It may be a new career. It may be a new job. It may just be, you know, a new place. Those to me are kind of the more internal indicators. Like, do you dread your existence on a daily basis? If you do, then yes, it's time to leave.
And maybe more than just finding a new job, money, if you're dreading your existence, right, on a daily basis.
Right. But. Well, and I mean, there's a concept of the golden handcuffs, right? Like, some people get into that position where it's like, well, I'm making really good money, right? I'm making great money. I'm never going to make as much as I'm making currently. And so I can't afford to leave, right? And I would say that that's generally false, right? From my experience, from what I've seen, changing jobs doesn't usually result in a decrease in pay.
Let me stop you on that, because you and I are both career changers who did that exact thing where we said, hey, you know what? This career is not working out for me. I got to find something else. And we did take that dip in pay from where we were in more successful careers. And so not always is that the case.
Fair enough, right? Fair enough. If you're switching entire career fields, then yeah, you're probably going to take a little bit of a drop in pay. Me specifically, I went from one career, nursing, healthcare, right, into the world of software development, right? And yeah, I took a $10,000 hit to do that. And within, you know, the first couple of years, you know, I was back up to what I was making previously. Right. And so I think a lot of the times your wage expectations will follow your work ethic, your work ability. And that's not always necessarily the truth at every single company that you'll work at. There may be companies that you just have to leave to be paid what you truly are worth. But you know, I think it's, do you want to leave? That's a yes or no internal question. I don't know how else to answer that.
No, I think kind of to echo what you said, Jake, I think, you know, everybody in their career, let's focus on a career as a software developer. Everybody in their career goes through, I think, both of the things you described, right? I think early in your career, you know, you would definitely change jobs for money, because when you're a junior developer with no experience, you're going to get paid a certain amount. And the speed at which you learn and develop is likely to far outpace the company's willingness to pay you more often than not. And, you know, you've got your little Maslow's hierarchy thing. And at some point you'd look, I got to make more money. I got bills to pay. You know, have you seen rent in Boise these days? Right. I think eventually you do get to a point though, where that is balanced out. And now you don't make a decision based on that alone. Right. And there's still that kind of, well, I'm worth more, so I'm going to leave, right? And there's that argument, absolutely. But there's also, well, I know I'm worth more, but I'm happy where I'm at. and the work I'm doing is fulfilling and I kind of enjoy who I'm working with. And I'm just like, is it worth the risk? Because, you know, the grass is not always greener. You may get more money. That does not mean the culture is the best fit. It doesn't mean you're happier in your new job. Right. And so, you know, it, like you said, whether it's golden handcuffs or not, like I said, it's more, you know, I'm happy where I'm at. And it's, you know, this is low risk to keep coming to work every day and enjoying myself. Like why stress about it? But, you know, ultimately I think, you know, depending on what your drive is and what your passion is, there's always likely to be new opportunity out there for you. I don't know if I necessarily agree with the you should always be looking thing. I think in the back of your head, maybe you should be, but there's a difference between actively looking and passively looking, right? Like, you know, keeping an eye out, keeping industry trends, knowing what's going on in the scene, in the space. That's useful. Keeping in touch with your contacts, whether they're people at other firms, whether they're recruiters or whatnot, you know, maintaining that network is important. But actively going out and sitting on every interview someone offers you, probably going to be a downer pretty quickly. you know, so be mindful about whether you're talking active or passive, right? I think there's a lot of ways to do that. But no, I think it's a very personal decision when it's actually time to move on. And again, I think you get to a certain point in your career and it's not just a numbers game anymore. There's far more important things to that move than oh, I got paid $20,000 more.
I think one of the important things in that I've seen, especially in this field, is, you know, all of that is true as well. But we have seen plenty of people even come to our school who are happy, who are in their job, who are loving what they do, but they've been writing the same basic, you know, 6 or 7 lines of script that they just maintained for 10 years or so. And I think that there's a certain part of that growth that you need to make sure, you know, what is your longevity in this field? And that's sometimes tied to, are you still growing or are you still deepening your understanding? Are you, you know, are increasing your breadth or depth of knowledge in your field? And there does sometimes reach a point that it says, hey, you know, I am kind of static in this position. And as much as I, you know, maybe enjoy the company or I enjoy the people that I'm with, you know, I'm not growing anymore. And what does that look like for the long term of my life in this type of career?
And I think that's interesting because I think that speaks back to passion, right? So there are plenty of people I think out there in the industry that are absolutely okay with that. It's like, I'm making enough. I write the same 4 lines every day. And you know what? That's cool. I go home on time. I play with my kids. Everything is predictable. And there's a lot of people that like that. That's a safe, comfortable feeling. I don't, you know, in technology in general, that's not generally the norm. Because to be in technology, it is an ever-changing world, right? And you know, lots of industries are like that. I'm not going to discount all the other industries. It's not like, you know, in healthcare, you don't keep on top of your toes, right? It's also an ever-changing industry. But, you know, there are a lot of industries where they're not moving at quite that pace. And, you know, to be in IT and to enjoy it, or to be in technology in general and enjoy it, there's definitely an element of that you have to be comfortable with. If you're not comfortable with that, and if you are comfortable with that, then the chances are you're kind of a self-motivated driver. You're kind of always kind of, oh, what's new? Oh, that sounds like view 3, huh? View 3.5, what's that? Right? There's always like, what does this do? How can it enable me to be better? And off you go down the rabbit hole, right? And if you're willing to do that, that's when it comes back to, well, now I feel a little less fulfilled because I know all this new stuff and I've put all these hours in and all this time. And, you know, you guys still think I'm only worth what I was worth then. Is like, whoa, you know, and that's when people start to get grumbly about things. Right. And, you know, talent teams and HR teams, I'm sure it's very difficult to keep up to it because you've always got these two different ends of the spectrum of staff. You've got the people that basically making the same amount year on year and they're loving their job and they're not driven to be more, and that's fine. And they're great staff and they do their job well. And you're like, absolutely appreciate what they do. But then you've got these other ones that are like, man, they ask for raises every 3 months. You know, and you're like, can we afford that? Why? I mean, that's not normal, right? Why do we have to do that? And then you look at who you're competing with in the software development space. You're like, whoa, that's not the world I used to remember.
I think that's something that you see just talking even about projects, right? Projects, development projects. Oftentimes, if you go, say, work for a company, depending on what team you're on, you may be in the stabilization phase, which is, you know, like you were just saying, you go to work Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, you punch a clock, you take an hour and a half for lunch. No one really cares. The work's not frantic. Nothing's on fire and everything's good and, you know, good and gold. Right. And sometimes that's a really nice position to be in. And then other times you could be working at that exact same company on a slightly different project that's in chaos mode, right? It's in ramp up. And, you know, it's where we have on call hours. Everything is frantically busy. The server keeps going down, right? We talk about this from that standpoint of you're constantly on call. You're constantly working. You're putting in those 80-hour work weeks, which at some point in time you will absolutely burn out on. But if that's the environment that you thrive in and that's what you love, then maybe that's okay for a little while.
And even if you don't thrive in, I think if you're, there's potential in most firms to jump between those types of role. And, you know, from a mental health perspective, you might want to be on the, okay, I'm on the stabilization team for a while. This is cool. I can go home on time. You know, I can get up an hour later and life is good. And then as eventually you'll be like, no, I'm not feeling, I need to be doing more. I need to be doing more. You know, I had a friend once who's making great money. He was working at an investment bank in London. And he calls me one day. He's like, man, I'm getting out of IT. I hate it. I'm like, what do you mean? I thought you loved your job. He's like, oh, I hate it. I was like, what? You do security at this investment bank. He's like, you know what I do all day? He's like, I reset AD passwords. Like, all day? He's like, that's my job. And I'm like, yeah, I'd get out of IT too at that point. But now, you know, and again, he hadn't been exposed to other parts of, you know, what was happening in the IT field at the time. And that was his job. He's like, again, he's getting paid plenty of money as a contractor at an investment bank, right? It's not a low paying job, whatever you're doing. But you know, the job itself, the work was very unfulfilling and very repetitive and very boring and didn't work for him. He's now taken that skill set, that IT security passion he had, and now he does IT security for another big firm, and he kind of heads the whole thing up, you know, years down the line kind of thing. But that's because he didn't get out of IT. He realized that there were ways for him to solve this problem without changing careers completely. And I think, you know, there's definitely times in technology, even if you do love the ever-changing nature of it, that you will get burnt out.
I think to build on that too, and a big factor that comes into play is the company you're working for, right? You could have very different experiences, and not to bring up an extreme case, but you know, Activision Blizzard, I think there are plenty of people there who had just awful experiences.
Not to bring up an extreme case.
Yeah, I'm going to bring it up anyway. People there obviously had awful experiences, but that doesn't necessarily represent technology as a whole. I think there are certain stereotypes and certain things we fall into in the developer community, that, you know, many of us also try and work against some of those norms. And are you going to find certain things in multiple places that do, and again, maybe not to that level of extreme, but fall within those similar kind of practices? Yeah, possibly. Unfortunately, that's the case. But I think that you need to understand and realize, people, it's not like that everywhere. And just because you hate this job, analyze whether it's, am I doing something that this company, is it a part of the company that's being done wrong? Or do I truly not enjoy maybe the challenge that comes with software development, or, you know, the mental kind of stress that comes with it? Because you will find mental exercise every single day in software development. It's just, it shouldn't be burdensome to the point where you're ending up in lawsuits due to some of the stress that you were put under.
Yeah, I think, as with all things, communication is key, right? Say you're working and, you know, you're on that 80-hour work week team and you're feeling burnt out. Transparency with your boss, right? Transparency with whoever your manager is. Like, man, I've got to take a break. You know, I love what I'm doing. This is a blast. But I've got this other stuff going on as well. You know, could I give you moved to one of these other stable teams for a little bit? Great. Perfect. Transparency, communication can often ultimately, you know, be the real key to workplace happiness, right? If you're not willing to communicate with your boss, then you probably should already be considering leaving, right? And that can be or that can be the boss. It could be, you know, the company. But ultimately, if you don't have clear lines of communication, then absolutely you're going to find, you know, unhappiness wherever you're at. I don't care how good of a company it is.
All right. Well, on that note, Jake, I think I'll stick around for a little bit longer. Good news for you. But we'll go ahead and wrap up this episode of the Dev Team.
That's a wrap for the Dev Team. If you enjoyed it, please be sure to subscribe to our channel for the latest content anywhere great podcasts are found. And remember, if you want clean code,
wash your hands.